Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Araqi Voices. This is your host, Hassan Haddad. Araqi Voices is produced by 1001 Araqi Thoughts. I'm joined once again by Ali Al-Mawlawi, Muhammad Al-Wa'ili, and Hamza Haddad. This week, we're going to talk about the government formation process, including the recent election of the Speaker of Parliament and his two deputies, the upcoming election of the President of the Republic, and the ongoing negotiations over the premiership. Ali, since we last spoke, we now have a Speaker of Parliament and his two deputies, and this came at the very end of 2025, where there was a two-day session of Parliament. Talk to us about what happened during those 2 days and how these gentlemen came to be as Speaker and deputies.
So the most significant aspect of the election of the Speaker and the two deputies is the fact that the political blocs were able to do this in accordance with the constitutional deadline. Of course, the constitution states clearly that this election needs to happen on the first session of parliament. And what's very significant is this is the first time that the blocs have been able to do this in 2 decades. In the past, what they have done is rely on this sort of legal loophole whereby they've left the first session open and then gone off for weeks, if not months, to renegotiate. This didn't happen this time around, which is, I think, very significant and worth discussing. But what happened, in fact, was the so-called National Council, the National Political Council, which is the umbrella group for the leading Sunni factions. It's the equivalent of the Shia coordination framework. They were able to achieve largely agreement on who would be the candidate, and that was Haybat al-Halbousi. The only leading faction that didn't sign up to this was Azm, led by Muthanna Samarai. He actually held a press conference on the very same evening, declaring that he had no intention of relinquishing his candidacy. Anyhow, what happened was that Haybat al-Halbousi was elected and did receive a majority support from both coordination framework factions and from the PUK.
Ali, why don't you tell us why it was Haybat al-Halbousi rather than Muhammad al-Halbousi who was contesting the speakership?
Well, Muhammad al-Halbousi, I think, came to the realization that he just didn't have the numbers to secure his re-election, not just within the Sunni factions, but also because of the very serious opposition from the KDP, and also factions within the coordination framework were unwilling to support his candidacy. And so he had to compromise. And I think what's important to point out is that what also forced him to compromise was the fact that he underperformed in the elections. And, you know, you often hear this as people will claim that the election results don't really matter because ultimately the blocs will then sit down and negotiate. But actually what this instance proves is that the results do matter, because had Taqaddum and Halbousi performed as well as they did in 2021, he wouldn't have been in this position. He could have very comfortably declared that he, as Taqaddum, holds a majority of Sunni seats in parliament, and so there's really nothing to negotiate. He could have done that had he performed a little bit better than what he did. And so that was really the driving force behind him having to concede to some degree. Of course, he was still very adamant that the speakership should go to his party, and he was able to do that by conceding his position.
And I think this sort of also indicates the rise of a different model in how to govern, which is this political bloc with a strong man leading it. And then for various reasons, including election results, he or she cannot basically take a certain position. So what they do is they nominate someone very close to them so that they can control them and allow them to fulfill their plan, basically, and their political agenda. And this started with Maliki when he wasn't able to become the prime minister for a third term. And it seems that others have copied this type of model. And in a sense, it has some positive benefits because it sort of strengthens the role of a political coalition. But the drawbacks of it is that you don't really deal with officials themselves, but rather with people who do not have a lot of stake. So it's a little bit tricky how to assess the situation, but this is happening a lot recently in Iraqi politics.
And let me just add to that point, which is that Mohamed Al-Halboussi had several options to fall back on as a replacement. And he chose essentially the weaker option, which is a relative, someone from his clan that he can control entirely. Someone that really doesn't meet the kind of caliber that is required for a Speaker of Parliament. He could have, for instance, chosen the deputy head of his party, Mohamed Tamim, who has a lot more experience in Parliament and also as a minister, and he has a lot more caliber. And he didn't do that because, of course, had Tamim secured the speakership for himself, that would have possibly created greater competition for Halboussi as this kind of leading figure of the party.
So that's how Haybet Al-Halboussi became the Speaker of Parliament. What about the two deputies? What can you tell us about that?
So the first deputy speaker that was elected was Adnan Feyhan, affiliated with Qais Al-Khaz'ali. But Feyhan, more importantly, was the governor of Babel. So he ran for a seat as governor, won the seat, resigned from being governor of Babel, and took on the deputy speaker role by winning 177 votes, ousting Mandelawi, who received 107 seat votes. And the way parliament works is in the first round of voting, if you don't get 165, it goes to a second round of voting between the top two vote getters. But there wasn't a need for that because, like I said, Feyhan received 177. And I think that really took Mohsen Mandelawi back, who probably thought he could retain his position. But what was more interesting than that was the election of the second deputy speaker. So also the incumbent, Shahwan Abdullah from the KDP, ran, and he was being contested by Ribwar Karim, who was running with the new opposition party, Hal West. Ribwar is not a new face. He's a former MP that served in the past as part of the Kurdish opposition. And when they ran, it was a tightly contested vote where he won 153 compared to Shahwan Abdullah's 117. But it was just short of the 165 votes needed. And this obviously caused an uproar for the KDP, who see this as their part of their quota in government and also their right as the party that won the most seats among the Kurds. So we were close to getting all speakers voted in the first day of the session, but this kind of threw a wrench in the plans of the established parties. And so it was postponed till the next morning, as one of the excuses was that it was past midnight by this time. But it really gave an opportunity for the KDP to regroup and figure out a way forward. And so the next day, they had nominated Farhad Al-Atrushi, who was the former governor of Dohuk, instead of Shahwan, who was able to win 178 votes compared to Ribwar Karim's 104. And I think this was a really missed opportunity of parliamentarians being re-empowered. There's been a lot of talk, like we were just saying, you know, a lot of the power that politicians hold is no longer contested within the halls of parliament. It's, you know, you have surrogates being nominated and in place. And this was an opportunity where parliamentarians had the chance to kind of voice themselves and say something different, but it just came up short and the KDP were able to get it together the next day. But it still, I think, sent a strong message.
So why is it that in the third round, Farhad Al-Atrushi was successful in getting the position and he comes from the KDP, whereas Shahwan wasn't able to get that position? Was there something specifically against him that the other parties could not get behind?
I think there's multiple reasons behind it. I think the first part, Shahwan had been in his position in the previous term, and you can create a lot of enemies during that time. Re-elected MPs might want someone else to deal with. I think the second aspect was that regardless of who the KDP's candidate was, that they were going to face competition from other parties with regards to proving why they deserve these positions in government. Kind of like the others, they made a big deal about how many individual votes they won in this election, and that if it was on the previous electoral law, they could have won more seats. But they always come within the 25 to 30 seat votes. And I think they had to prove or convince others of why they were deserving of this. So I think they needed to do more backroom deals to be able to get their candidate through. And the other fact is, Farhad al-Atroshi, he does come from the Nechervan Barzani camp, which is the one that's more liked in Baghdad than the Masroor Barzani camp. All those three could have been a reason, but I don't think there was one specific one.
Yeah, so there's lots of things happening at the same time here. Another dimension, another way of looking at this, is the fact that Mohamed Halbousi had to give up his aspirations to be speaker and offer an alternative, in part because of the KDP opposition. And so almost to reciprocate, tried to force the same thing on the KDP. So Shahwan Abdullah wanted to retain his position, and they forced the KDP also to relinquish that claim and to offer an alternative.
All right. So speaking of the competing parties, perfect segue to the next step in government formation process, which is the election of the president of the republic. Where do we stand? Who are the main competitors? When can we expect a session to vote on the president?
So parliament opened up nominations for the presidency on December 30th. And to kind of maintain the momentum of this government formation, sticking to constitutional timeline, it was only open for 3 days. And there were 81 nominations submitted. And as of the recording, there's just about less than 20 that were approved to run for president. According to Article 68, stipulates they must be born to Iraqi parents, at least 40 years old. And here's where it gets tricky, quote, of good reputation and political experience, known for their integrity, uprightness, fairness, and loyalty to the homeland. And so I think that's where a lot of the nominees were filtered out. And so the three main ones that we have is the PUK nominated Nizar Ahmadi, who's a longtime advisor to multiple Iraqi presidents from 2008 to 2022. He later became part of the Sudani government as Minister of Environment from 2022, but later resigned in October 2024 when he became the head of the PUK's political bureau in Baghdad. And so he's the PUK's nominee. Meanwhile, the KDP, for the third time in a row, have nominated Fuad Hussein, who we know lost out to Barham Saleh in 2018, lost out to Abdel Latif Rashid in 2022. And I don't think he really has a chance this time around. And then, of course, I just mentioned Abdel Latif Rashid, who served as president in the last term. The Constitution allows a president up to two terms, and he is a nominee once again. And you might be wondering, then, why isn't he being nominated by the PUK? And the main reason behind that is Bafel Talabani, the head of the PUK party, wants someone that he can control more, more loyal. Again, it goes back to that kind of what we were speaking about, what Mohammed said about parties choosing someone else to represent them in office. And Abdel Latif Rashid he's one of the old-time politicians. He's his uncle through marriage, so he's Jalal Talabani's brother-in-law. But he comes from that older generation, from Iraqi opposition days, later became a minister and advisor to the president. And so, yes, he's from the PUK. Yes, he's related. But Bafel doesn't have the same control over Rashid than he would for someone else. And so that's why he's pushing for Nizar. And we'll have to see as to whether, you know, the PUK will get their candidate or politics will force them to compromise once more and elect Rashid. But to kind of focus on that, we did see the head of the judiciary, Faik Zeidan, travel to Erbil on January 3rd. where he met with Mas'oud Barzani, head of the KDP. And 5 days later, PUK and KDP delegations met with one another. The KDP was headed by Hoshar Zebari, former Minister of Foreign Affairs and Finance, and the PUK was represented by Qubad Talabani, who is the deputy KRG prime minister and younger brother of Bafol. But that meeting didn't actually result in anything. If anything, it kind of complicated matters further, because if we keep in mind, the KRG held elections on October 20, 2024, and they still haven't formed a government. And those elections themselves were delayed by 2 years. And so if they try to package that all in one, then it makes things very complicated and might jeopardize this Iraqi government formation from sticking within the constitutional timeline. Because as Article 72 stipulates, the president has to be elected within the first 30 days of the first parliament session. So that would be January 28, which we're nearing. And this just once again shows the deep divisions within the Kurdish parties that, you know, they can't hold elections on time. They can't form a regional government. That's spilling over into federal politics. And even, you know, the Sudani government, when it was formed in October 2022, if you remember, 21 of 23 cabinet ministers were voted in by parliament. And there were two vacant because there was, you know, a disagreement between the KDP and PUK over the four ministries allotted to the Kurdish parties, with the KDP claiming that they have the right to three of the four because the PUK were getting the presidency. And, you know, that wasn't resolved till 2 months later, which when it was eventually settled on 2 and 2.
So if they're unable to form a regional government 15 months after they held regional elections, what are the chances they're able to come to some sort of compromise and understanding on the president and assuming the cabinet ministers and the regional government within the next 2 weeks?
I think it's going to be very complicated for them. And what makes it even more complicated is that sometimes those quote-unquote surrogate candidates become their own men, and then they start to make decisions and political moves that do not necessarily align with the party strongman's agenda. This happened, for instance, with Bafol Talabani and Barham Saleh, who was actually not part of PUK anymore. And part of the deal to bringing him back was that he becomes president, and Bafol actually succeeded in that. But what happened is then that Dr. Barham Saleh sort of had his own agenda, and he sort of created a new model for the Iraqi presidency in which it is more involved and more active. And obviously, this did not sit well with Bafol Talabani. And it also did not sit well necessarily with all the other political parties. So this is why we had, after that, Abdul Latif Rashid, who was also a little bit more laid back and not involved. And yet, he wasn't easily controllable for Bafol. So I think what Bafol is trying to do is find someone that he has strong influence over and someone who will actually implement his agenda in Baghdad. And that would then solidify his share when he negotiates with the KDP. This is why I think Bafol Talabani this time is trying to make sure that the surrogate model that he tries to build in Baghdad is not compromised again, and that he can negotiate better with the KDP and sort of solidify his share, his political share in the process.
And another angle worth looking at is how Mas'oud Barzani has been messaging over the past couple of weeks. You know, his emphasis has been on the fact that it's for the Kurds to decide on the presidency and that no other factions should have any involvement in determining that process. The lesson is that if you are divided as Kurds, then that opens space for both the Sunni factions and the Shia factions to voice an opinion on the presidency. And again, look back at what the Sunni factions did. They formed their own coordination framework. And part of that motivation is to ensure that it's for the Sunnis to decide on who becomes a speaker. And there really is a lesson here for the Kurds in that if they do not mend their differences, if they are not able to operate as a unified bloc in Baghdad, then what happens is that other factions will also try to influence the process of the presidential election.
And to add to your point, Ali, if you remember in the last election, government formation stalled at the choosing of the president because, you know, we had the legal question of two-thirds to vote for a president. So when it comes to the session of voting a president, quorum requires two-thirds and not just the 51%. And so if the KDP wanted to delay this, are they able to get 108 MPs to prevent quorum from happening? Keep in mind they have 25 plus their proxies that they won through the minority quotas. It still would be very tough for them to be able to garner that amount of MPs. I don't think they'll want it to reach that point, keeping in mind that the PUK, you know, does have of a stronger support system in Baghdad.
Brilliant insights into Kurdish politics and how it's playing out here in Baghdad. Let's now talk a little bit about the negotiations taking place for the position of prime minister and the announcement by sitting Prime Minister Sudani that he will no longer seek a second term.
So there's an analysis floating that this is basically a smart political move by Sudani to basically nominate or support the nomination of Nour al-Maliki to become the next prime minister. And the reason why this analysis thinks that this was smart is because Maliki does not seem to have the support of various sites that actually have a say in government formation, which includes basically international forces, internal forces. Even within the coordination framework, there's some opposition against him. Some even claim that the Marja'iyya is also not okay with him being the next prime minister, despite the fact that the Marja'iyya says, we do not comment on any candidate for the prime ministership. But this analysis does not necessarily take into consideration the weak points that Sudani has, which is not necessarily a cohesive coalition, and other issues, which includes the wiretaping scandal and the fact that his spending regimen was disastrous for the Iraqi coffers. But this seems to be like the rationale that maybe supporters of Sudani are trying to circulate around. But it remains to be seen whether this is actually true or not. As for Maliki, I do believe that he has various options, and I do not believe that he himself is going to run and become the prime minister. But it's very possible that he's negotiating on behalf of someone else and that he will eventually then step back after he has prepared the arena for whoever is in his mind to become the next PM.
So the biggest adversaries going into the election were Sudani and Maliki. How is it that they were able to come together and hold several meetings over several days and come to this conclusion that Sudani isn't seeking a second term and that he endorses Maliki's nomination for a third term?
So I think in order to understand how we got to where we are right now, you really have to take a step back and look at the evolution of the coordination framework as an organization, because it is now more than 4 years old. And as we know, the CF, the coordination framework, was conceived of as an umbrella organization whereby the leading Shia factions would sit around a table and they would all have an equal opinion on matters to do with the future prime minister. And this is what incentivized all of these factions to come and sit together, which is that regardless of how big or small you are as a party in parliament, we're all equal around the table. And this is one of the strengths that has enabled the coordination framework to last for as long as it has. However, I do think that you have to think about the natural evolution of how decision-making takes place under this sort of arrangement. If you think about how decisions have been made in the past, including with the decision to nominate Hamid Sudani back in 2022, It was based on this principle of tawafuq, this collective decision-making. And it's kind of like the permanent members of the Security Council. So in order to pass a resolution, you either need the permanent members to all agree, or you need at least no one to veto the resolution. And in the same token, with the coordination framework, all of the members of that framework decided to support the nomination of Sudani. I think only Maliki is on the record as saying that he wasn't in favor of his nomination, but he didn't oppose it, so he didn't veto it. And this is how the framework has gone about making decisions. Now, the problem is that after 4 years, the size of the framework has expanded significantly. So if you think back, they had around 7 core members 4 years ago. Now you have upwards of 14 to 15 members. So you now have people like Mohsen al-Mandalawi, who wasn't there before, Ahmed al-Asadi, and then of course you have Mohamed al-Sudani as a core member of this group. And so the idea that this large group of people are going to come to a collective decision on who to choose for the premiership is actually very, very difficult. The only way is to seek the lowest common denominator, meaning that you choose a very weak prime minister that has no political bloc backing him. And this, of course, is not ideal, particularly given the challenges that Iraq faces. You do need someone that can, you know, really have a backbone, that can make decisions that are both unpopular amongst the leading political elite, as well as making decisions that are unpopular amongst the general public if we are, you know, genuinely committed to sort of a reform agenda. And so the point that I'm trying to make is that there is almost like a natural evolution to how decisions are made in an organization like the framework, even though they have been very adamant up until now that the decision for the premiership will be done through tawafuq, through this collective decision-making. What we have seen is that both Maliki and Sudani have said, hold on a second, maybe this is not the fairest way to make a decision because we both have the largest two blocks, and it doesn't make sense when they're sitting around the table and looking at their counterparts to think that their opinion is equal to the opinion of someone who only has maybe a handful of seats in parliament or maybe no seats in parliament. And so I just think that even though it was unforeseen that someone like Maliki would sit down with Sudani, given all of their differences that they've had over the past 3 years, in many respects, it kind of makes sense that these two leaders would come to this realization that actually they have more in common when it comes to influencing the process whereby the next prime minister is chosen.
This seems to be a theme, given what we said about Masoud Barzani and Kurdish politics, and given that the KDP happen to be the highest vote getters. Same thing when it comes to Halbousi and Sunni politics and how well Taqaddum does. So I guess it's natural that Maliki and Sudani, given that together they make up a majority within the coordination framework, that they would have this sort of mentality as well.
Yeah, so again, go back to the National Political Council, the Sunni coordination framework. Their basis on the speakership was that it would be based on collective decision-making. And it's even actually written within the founding document that the decision would be made through collective agreement. And they weren't able to achieve that. They came close, but of course, as I mentioned, Muthanna Samarai refused to sign up to Haybat al-Halbousi's nomination. Similarly, I think, given that the coordination framework has far more members than the Sunni version, the Sunni version only had 5 core members, the framework is actually in a very difficult position because either it has to stick to and abide by this core principle of tawafuq and end up with a very weak prime minister who is lowest common denominator, or you accept that there is a natural progression in how decisions are made in such an organization. And this is what I believe fundamentally both Maliki and Sudani have been trying to assert through this rapprochement that has happened over the past week or so. I think there are 2 key assertions that they're making. The first is that the prime minister should be beholden to a unitary party or a bloc, that it doesn't make sense that a prime minister does not belong to any of the leading Shia factions. And we've seen, you know, both the example of Mustafa al-Kadhimi and Hamid Shia al-Sudani. There is really very little accountability when the prime minister is not beholden to a particular party. And this is not good, really, in terms of democratic practice, in my view anyway. It really undermines accountability. The second assertion is that decision-making within the coordination framework should account for the number of seats that each of the various members have in parliament. Again, because if you are trying to assert your opinion on who you think is the best candidate, you're going to look around the room and you're going to see that there's disparity in how many seats you have versus how many seats the smaller parties have. And so these, I think, are the two core precedents that both Maliki and Sudani are trying to assert. I don't think they've got past the finish line on this, but I do think that this is their kind of core agenda in trying to reshape the coordination framework.
Ali, I do have to point out that it is ironic, though, after last government formation and what the Shia coordination framework, in particular Maliki, did to force Muqtada al-Sadr out when he did have 72 or 73 seats. And this, we can call it politics, that, you know, you push what makes sense for you today and the past doesn't matter, but it will have consequences on future government formation if Muqtada does decide to return to politics and run. As he did show, he's capable of winning the most seats, whether it's the current electoral system, like he did in 2018, or the one we had in 2021. So this could lead to problems down the road, and it does show the hypocrisy, particularly among someone like Noureddin Maliki.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think the counter argument would be that the coordination framework is the largest bloc in parliament. And even back in 2021, there was an attempt by the coordination framework to establish itself as the largest bloc in competition with Muqtada al-Sadr's claim. So in many respects, the informal rules of the game haven't fundamentally changed, and they're still adhering to the sort of the constitutional aspect of it, which is that the largest bloc is the one that decides who will be the prime minister. What I think is interesting is, within the largest bloc, what are the internal dynamics that are happening? And for me, what I see is that there's a lot of flux within the coordination framework. There's clearly no agreement within the leading blocs as to how the decision is going to be made on the premiership. And there are, for me, two competing visions that are trying to assert themselves. You have, on the one hand, the Sudani Maliki approach, and on the other, you have the likes of Ammar al-Hakim and Qais al-Khaz'ali, who appear to be trying to stall this process.
So what we're seeing is, in theory, the political elites would like to keep the decision-making within their component and not have others get involved. But when it comes to practice, the Shia parties and the Kurdish parties are struggling to come to that agreement within themselves, which, if it does take longer, goes beyond constitutional timeline like the last government formation, then you might start to see others get involved and influence the decision-making.
Speaking of constitutional timelines, that's something that we've been talking about, hearing about quite a bit since before the elections were held. They are giving us hope that we could potentially have a new government formed in record time, definitely shorter than the government formation process of 2021 and 2022, which was greater than 1 year. Why is this issue so significant this year?
Well, I would go back to what I've said in the past, which is looking at the political order. And in my estimation, this order is maturing to some degree. What you have now is what the literature would describe as rule of law at the elite level, meaning that the ruling elite are establishing a set of clear informal rules about how they deal with each other, how they negotiate. And while there have been rules that have existed in the past, they are becoming a lot more predictable in how both they manage conflict and how they form governments. That, for me, is looking conceptually at the political order, what is most interesting about what's happened over the past few weeks. And the first litmus test was whether the election of the speakership would take place on time, and it has. Now we have a huge challenge in electing the president because of the two-thirds rule. And so there is a chance that the momentum that has been formed could get derailed when we get to the end of this month and it's time to elect the president. However, I do think that broadly the trend does suggest that the elite, while obviously seeking their own interests and seeking to, you know, assert control over as much of the state as they can, are developing these informal rules that allow greater predictability with regards to how they negotiate between each other.
I completely agree with Ali about this. I want to add the fact that I think few people appreciate how complicated this process is and how actually 20 plus years is actually nothing when it comes to institutionalization and political development. You have always to remember that Iraq went through civil war, violence, occupation. There's still a lot of corruption existing. It's located in a very unstable region in the world. And to actually reach this level where you have a functioning political process, despite the fact that it's very imperfect, this is something important. We should not forget how much Iraqis had to sacrifice in order to achieve this, and how they, especially through the last election, showed that they actually want this system and they want to continue with it, even though it's imperfect. I was talking with Hamza the other day about the fact, for instance, that the judiciary, despite the fact that it has a lot of problems, it still is very important that it has an important role, that it's getting stronger, and will take time until it reaches a level where it's basically functioning based on the law. But nevertheless, it's not just for show. It's not in the background. It's actually now active. And any functional democracy needs this.
And to reinforce what Mohammed said, look at the Arab Spring. Egypt wasn't able to get past one election. Tunisia, which was the success story, stumbled after a few government formations before it backtracked into authoritarianism. And so for Iraq to continue to have elections, transitions of power, especially in a volatile region, I think that is very important. And the fact that, you know, we're having pressure from the judiciary to abide by constitutional timeline is not only important for long-term institution building, but also in the short term. There's a lot of instability both in Iran and Syria. And it is in Iraq's interest to have a government that's not on an interim basis to be able to handle any situation that may arise.
Yeah, and one final point I'd add is that sometimes as analysts and researchers, we can get stuck in the weeds a bit. You know, we can get fixated by the actors that are involved in the political process and lose sight of the overall goal, which is, in to my mind, the establishment of a parliamentary democracy in Iraq that is fully functional, that is coupled with real rule of law. And, you know, I say this all the time, there is no perfect political system. But I do believe that parliamentary democracy is the best system that Iraq can offer to its people over the long term. If you take into account Iraq's history, the turbulent, violent history, the fact that Iraq went through a totalitarian period, that a parliamentary system offers the best possible guarantor against Iraq reverting back to authoritarianism. And so really the metric by which you measure success is to what extent are the roots of a parliamentary democracy strengthening in Iraq. And of course, the entire process is imperfect. And it's very easy to get sidetracked by a focus on how self-interested and how corrupt the ruling elite are. But I do think that it's important to think about the overall trend. And as Mohammed pointed out, 20 years in the lifetime of effectively a new state, a new political order, is really not a very long time at all.
I want to thank you, gentlemen, for joining me today for this very informative conversation. That's it for this week's episode. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify to receive notifications about a new episode from Iraqi Voices. Until next time, take care.